curious. Some data from the Employment Department and from the Regional Workforce Investment Board that I'm familiar with, and I was somewhat dismayed to find out in a highly educated county, relatively I suppose, because of the University of Oregon in Lane County, that their average wages are actually up to 15% below the state's average. And so I wonder about the focus of those workforce development grants and those sorts of investments and how they're basically on the same page with the Economic Development Department in trying to accomplish these missions. And I'm just wondering where your agency is at with some sort of collaboration with workforce investment.
Chair Johnson, Representative Holvey, for the record, Mike Salzgiver, Deputy Director, OECDD. I'm going to try to do a multi-part answer, and I hope I'm being responsive. If I'm not, smack me and I'll come back to it. Some quick history. In the past, the agency did have a separate or a distinct workforce development section that was a manager was dedicated for the purpose of driving workforce development activity and collaborating with other parts of the government to achieve that role. When the headcount started shrinking at the beginning of the 2001 period, when the recession really took hold and all agencies were being, ours in particular, was being asked to reduce itself, that function went away. And as a general rule, much like private sector, we sort of absorbed an ongoing need into existing headcount. And so our business development manager at that time, Ron Fox, who has just left the agency to take over as executive director of the Southern Oregon Regional Economic Development entity. Ron has been our primary liaison to workforce activity. Most of it is driven out of the governor's office. Leah Culligan is the governor's workforce development advisor. She works closely with Campos Bali to drive workforce development policy and programs. And so we interact with them on a fairly regular basis. Ron was our agency's representative on the Oregon Workforce Investment Board and is also a member of the Governor's Workforce Policy Cabinet, which is a task force of agency representatives who are charged with developing and driving workforce policy. So that is really right now the extent of our activity. It's more of a liaison function. Now, as we are moving forward in our development of concepts and preliminary budget development, we are evaluating how we enhance our relationship to this as an agency. When we talk to businesses, one of the predominant feedback items that we get from the private sector is the need for help on workforce development. And so we are beginning to evaluate that in the context of developing both legislative concepts and the budget that we will recommend to the governor, and we will have more for you as that process unfolds. Right now, though, I would say it's primarily a liaison role, and one small fund we do have left that is discretionary in nature is the Industry Sector Outreach Fund. This last session, it had about $500,000 in it, and some of that was used for workforce development support. But beyond that, we don't have a lot of dedicated funds to go there.
Thank you, and I appreciate your answer. But I guess I'm sort of wondering about the policy and targeting where economic development money goes, and you know, making it coincide with that mission, and making sure workforce development is actually on the table and is being considered when you're using those funds to target economic development. I guess that's kind of where I was going.
Right, Mr. Chairman, Madam Chair, Representative Hovey, at this point, we know we have clear guidance from the governor's office that it is a priority of his. We are hearing it on a growing basis from the legislature, and we are hearing it consistently from the private sector. And as we now have moved into our strategic planning reset and refocusing ourselves and redefining our objectives, we have put it there. Our commission has reviewed it. They have indicated their consent with it. And so I think what you're going to see is a more focused and we hope resource-supported effort going forward.
Thank you. Any other questions on the statutory review? Then, Ms. Beaton, I'd ask you to comment on organizationally what's been happening to the agency since we were all last together.
Madam Chair, yes, I can.
Actually, to the degree that you're able to comment both from end of session, because I think it's useful to have the committee reminded that there's been a significant organizational change since end of session, and then there have been some short-term changes that have occurred just recently.
Yes. Madam Chair, yes. The most significant change is since the end of session to now, we're actually on our third agency director, which is always exciting. And so following session, Director Brantley left us, and at that time, Mike became our interim director. And while working with Mike predominantly, we did look at the organizational structure and say, how can we try to simplify this? What we've done is take essentially eight divisions and combine them into four. And I think that in your overheads, you have a chart. It's also up there on the overhead. And those four divisions are central operations, which is where we keep the functions like fiscal and finance that really deal with the entire agency. And those are the groups that have to serve the rest of the department so that they can do their work. The community development division, which is next, includes ports, transportation, and our infrastructure programs predominantly. And those folks work with different communities around the state to get money out the door. Again, one of the things here that was different is ports were a separate group, and we have put them into community development within our business and trade division. And we've actually combined three different groups there that were separate before. Our international division became sort of an international section within that division. You're going to hear more about that from later speakers. And we combined our small business, our recruitment staff, and then finally our marketing and Brand Oregon staff. And then finally, we've got a new division that was created coming out of session last time. The Innovation and Economic Strategies Division is a group that's really looking at staying innovative. What we are hearing consistently is that the best way for companies and businesses to be able to compete is to stay innovative and keep changing and keep adapting. And so that division is charged with working with different committees that are looking at how the state can best serve that function and help with that. I can go into detail if you want on how we move folks around. I would say that I think that what we're finding is our management team became tighter. We became a better unit, I think, frankly, under Mike, to give him credit for this. And also we're finding that when people are part of the same division, they start talking to each other more. I mean, even if what you're just doing is moving them around a little bit on the floor and saying, hi, you're actually a single unit now, it does make a difference with how people function and who they talk with and how collaborative they are and how they work together. And frankly, I think we're seeing a real improvement. Probably the change that the public will have seen most dramatically is speeding up of getting our contracts out the door. They have sped up dramatically in terms of how we're getting those put together and how we're processing them through the agency, I think largely because we have a more streamlined structure.
Colleagues, I would share with you that that had been a source of a great deal of irritation with the agency in times gone by, how quickly contracts were processed, and particularly how quickly grant awards got out the door. Senator Nelson.
Yes, thank you. Just to give some good kudos, in my part of the country, Eastern Oregon, Joe Miles does a great job. she works very well with all the agencies, but I hear from some of my other colleagues that that doesn't happen all the way throughout the state. I mean, in our part of the country, they just run everything together and the people work together for all their agencies. Is there anything that's being done about that on a statewide basis?
Yes, Madam Chair, Senator Nelson, I think what's being done is better management. Frankly, I think we as the management team are trying to take that job more seriously and not just being program experts ourselves, but in actually managing staff and finding out who is working well with everybody, what else do they need in order to do their job better, who's having problems in a certain region, and then dealing with that. And to be truthful, you've seen a little bit of turnover in the last few months because we have been dealing with that. And I do know that Jill and her team work together very well. There's a few other groups that also work together very well, and then some others not so well. And those, we frankly are moving staff around, and we're working with staff to see if we can't get better relationships going so they function better as a team.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, if I might as well. Chair Johnson, Senator Nelson, another factor at play there is I think in rural parts of the state where communities have fewer resources available to them, the personnel and teams that we have there probably do play a much larger, more visible role than, say, in the Portland metropolitan area or in Lane and in the more developed areas. And frankly, there's a lot more players, organizations, and infrastructure, if you will, that is in place. And so our members tend to be less visible there because they're part of a much larger team.
Any other comments or questions for
the individual?
Representative Thatcher. Thank you. I do have a question. I don't know how to phrase this, but in my 14 years of owning my small business, I don't think I've had a whole lot of interaction with your agency on a large level. I mean, I'm sure there's been things through the local TED Center. I can't remember what it stands for, but I'm just wondering who are the businesses that come to you? Just, you don't have to name names. I'm just wondering what sectors, do they come from one sector more than another, one region of the state more than another? Where do they come from?
Madam Chair, Representative Thatcher, I think it's fair to say that probably the companies we hear from first are some of the large ones that are either relocating within the state, coming to the state, trying to expand, simply because they're the ones who often think of this department first, I think, and will contact us. What we are trying to do is do a better job at helping reaching small businesses, and frankly, that's the next thing we're going to talk about, are the small business development centers, which is one of the primary ways that we try to help fund outreach to small business, and we have some questions about whether that's working as effectively as it could be. We also, as an agency, now have Victoria Pruitt, who's in the audience, who's just recently been named as our small business specialist, and she's at a higher level than we've had that function before because we're hoping she can really do a lot of that outreach and go to a lot of the small business centers, to the associations, and to the communities to try to explain what we can provide and how they can get those resources. Because it's definitely true that it's harder to reach the small businesses. There's so many more of them, and often they have more limited resources in terms of being able to reach out and knowing where to go and knowing how to reach us. So we're trying to do a better job of that.
Representative Thatcher, you could not have asked a better question.
It was planted. No,
what will we about this time? Ask this one. It couldn't have turned out better if it would have been planted. And with the committee's indulgence, I'd like to move right into addressing your question. One of the things that had happened in our first meeting together, taking us all back to February the 8th, we had Bill Carter from the SBDCs before us, and we had asked him very specifically and on the record if he would provide some of the benchmarks that were going to be included in his SBDC contract with OECDD. And regrettably, he chose to ignore the committee request. And then I think you all will, if I refresh your memory, will remember that we directed the committee administrator on behalf of the committee to make the request again. And Mr. Keller did that. And once again, Mr. Carter chose to ignore that committee request and went directly into negotiations with the agency for what his contract with the agency on behalf of the Small Business Development Centers ought to contain. The contract is now signed without the benefit of the joint committee having any input into what the benchmarks for performance might have been, and that speaks directly to your question. The contract is signed, and it's my understanding cannot be amended save for agreement of both the parties. But I would like to submit to this panel that unless we have some measurable that says how well the SPVC's council businesses, we're not going to know whether or not we're getting value for a multi-million dollar investment. And my concern is that we don't have any kind of calculus in the contract or in the benchmarks that says how can we judge the effect of the SBDC's council businesses versus those that aren't council. And I would submit to you, unless we're keeping that metric, we're not going to know how successful the SBDC counseling program is. And I would be happy to hear from the agency on that point, but I think the absence of that benchmark in this contract is almost fatal. And I would welcome any of your observations as well as the agency's. Ms. Beaton, you want to comment on that?
Madam Chair, yes. What we have provided in front of you as well as up on the screen is just a quick overview of the way the contract does look. Basically, it's divided into two parts. There was a direct line allocation put into the budget for $3.3 million total for the network. $2.2 million of that is going to what we refer to as the base services, so the usual services that the centers have been providing for a number of years. And those services are listed as assisting with business plan preparation, with financial management, personnel management, etc. In trying to develop a contract, working with the centers that would help measure that, we put together metrics working with them. And it is very true and easy to say that it was somewhat challenging. And coming up with metrics that are really strong, I don't think we quite got there. What we did settle on were the metrics that you see in front of you, involving the total number of clients that would receive 1 hour of counseling, the number of minority and or women-owned businesses that are served, the number of clients assisted in rural distressed communities, and then the number of jobs retained or created. So those metrics are what we put into the contract for the base of $2.2 million after negotiating with Mr. Carter. The second piece of the contract is new. It's different. It's dealing with a technology initiative. We're trying to assist the small business development centers to provide better information dealing with technology to businesses to help them to become startups, to help them to succeed and to grow. This is a new program. Mr. Carter has hired four people, specialists, who are located around the state to be able to provide assistance to companies that want information dealing with technology and how it can assist their businesses. And the metrics for that, switch, are trying to help identify high opportunity small businesses that might have the potential for rapid growth, counseling 216 to 300 of those companies. Again, the same type of benchmark we have in our base contract is trying to increase the number of jobs created and or retained and increase the number of counseled companies that apply for and receive financing. Also, finally, to establish standards that would apply to allowing these companies to become accredited at the national level as being technology related. The final slide or piece that you'll see is just the breakdown of the budget. We just wanted you to be aware of the fact that currently this line item provides about a third of the overall funding for the small business development centers. And again, it's broken into the two pieces from us, those in red, which is the base budget of $2.2 million, and then the technology initiative budget of $1.1 million. And we are interested in trying to have a stronger contract, frankly, and we welcome ideas on what type of benchmarks you would like to see. In listening to a progress board report a few weeks ago and listening to Senator Schrader, who's also the chair of the JLAC committee, and the Joint Legislative Audits Committee is the committee that actually has final approval for this document, and in speaking with him just yesterday, he's told me that he's not really pleased with the contract metrics, the way where they are now and would be interested in seeing us have stronger language, which we are interested in as well. But in listening to him at the Progress Board meeting, he was very clear in stating that what he is looking for from agencies overall, but specifically this contract right now, is having us look less at just the outputs and more at outcomes. And the way he described it was, rather than just sort of measuring the widgets and measuring who you're talking to and how many pieces of paper go out the door, what are you really doing as a result? Are you really, in this case, helping small businesses? And if so, how do you measure that? So he is interested in seeing us potentially amend this contract to try to deal with a performance measure that really deals with an outcome. We're very supportive of that and would welcome feedback on what you might want to see to accomplish that.
Madam Chair.
Representative Tomei.
Thank you. Could you talk a little bit more about making this request for information, not getting it, and not having any input on the performance measurements?
Well, I pretty much have told you everything that I know. Mr. Carter sat before this joint committee, and I think it was my request for additional information, and I was, on behalf of the committee, frankly ignored. And I tried to strengthen the request by asking for the committee's acknowledgement that we ask our committee administrator to inquire again. And Mr. Keller, I don't know if you have anything to add to this directly. You're perfectly capable of speaking for yourself.
Well, I was sitting here thinking, when I may have made the request, I'm not sure where it fell with the signing of the contract. It may have been after the contract was signed and
Madam Chair, Committee Administrator Keller. Yes, the contract had been negotiated but actually had not had a final signature put on it by the centers. So although we had finished our part and had signed, they had not yet signed, so we still had an opportunity for amendment if we needed to.
I would make the observation that there may be some fault on both sides here. If you guys signed a contract that you thought was deficient on its face, that's regrettable, but I clearly think it's within the purview of the legislature, even in the face of a contract that's executed, that may have deficient protections for a $9 million investment, that it would be within the purview of this committee to either recommend to the agency or recommend to the Joint Legislative Audit Committee that there be some strengthening language with respect to benchmarks inserted into this contract. Now, I don't know what difficulties this presents because the contract language is really quite clear on the fact that the agreement may not be waived, altered, modified, supplemented, or amended in any manner except by written instruments signed by both parties. It would be, I don't understand why Mr. Carter would resist benchmarks that demonstrated how efficacious his program was. So it would be beyond me why he would fight an addendum. And I don't want to disrupt the entirety of the signed instrument, so I'm recommending that if we make a recommendation that it would come in the form of an addendum to this contract. He was invited to be here today and is not. And so I'm very concerned that a legislature in a Ways and Means process that is particularly concerned about measurables and deliverables now has a contract that isn't, in the agency's opinion, strong enough, and in the opinion of some of our legislative colleagues, is not strong enough.
Can you follow up, please?
Representative,
so I'm not sure if you can answer this to somebody at the table, but to whom does he answer?
Ms. Beaton?
Madam Chair? Madam Chair, I believe that he answers to his network, but he receives funding from at least three different sources and has to have contracts with us, with the Small Business Association, and with, would be the third.
The other is the university system and the community colleges, where the centers are housed.
Oh, I'm sorry, Victoria Pruitt.
Madam Chair. Representative Thatcher, Small Business Manager for OECD. There is a national association that credits the community development centers all across the country. They are the ones who would be accrediting the SBDCs as a technology center. I believe that's the network that Mr. Carter answers up through, but he is funded by three sources: ourselves, the university systems, and community colleges where they're housed. And part of that 3.8 is, I believe, an in-kind contribution, not cash, and then the Small Business Administration, which is federal funding.
Follow up,
Representative Tomei.
Thank you. So If the answer's to your agency and you were aware of the request that was made by this committee, how could you not see that it was responded to?
Madam Chair, Representative Tomei, we didn't know exactly what the discussion was. We knew that he had been asked to prevent in or present information, and he did give us some information, but it wasn't, as we have now learned, frankly, I've learned this week, what had been asked of him. So we knew there had been discussion. We knew that he was supposed to come back with different ideas. We really didn't get that from him, so we proceeded not knowing that there had been a specific request for an outcome-based performance measure.
Yes, Bert.
Chair Johnson and Representative Tomei, to follow on to that, there was a communication that went from Mr. Carter to Senator Schrader, and I believe in that he felt that he was responding. He copied Senator Johnson. It wasn't in regard specifics to the contracts. It actually was more of a business delivery model of how they service small business and how they look at performance metrics. So it really didn't respond directly to what Senator Johnson had requested, even though I believe that the senators believed that they had responded. And at that point, Senator Schrader had responded and then also had gotten into the loop as far as performance measures and giving his input.
Colleagues, I would submit to you that this lays down one of the fundamental disconnects that has made it so difficult for the legislature to communicate with this agency. And it might be something that collectively we'd want to give some thought to. Is the communication on performance measures with the co-chair? Is it with the operative interim committee? Is it with the agency? And frankly, I don't know the answer. But it appears now that we have a contract that the agency believes is deficient in its measurables, that our colleagues in the legislature believe is deficient in its measurables. And I would like at least to move forward. We have a number of invited guests, and Representative Richardson is awaiting a telephone call. I would like to move forward today with a sense of the committee that to the degree we can encourage the two parties to open this contract by vehicle of an addendum and strengthen some of these performance measures, that we might be all better served when we go into the next session to find out, are we getting value for a $9 million public investment? And I would welcome the sense of the committee.
Hey, Madam Chair.
Co-chair Lester.
It was disturbing when the chair of this committee asking for some information and didn't get in time. It is very disturbing. And what we can ask at this time, we ask him to appear at the next committee meeting to explain why he was not able to respond, and whether he can bring more information to us. We didn't ask to respond to the Senator Schrader. You requested information to this committee, and the information should be provided to this committee. And so I'm proposing, Madam Chair, asking him to come next the committee meeting to explain what happened and any result of the outcome, so we can be better informed. In my opinion, we are not here to micromanage of this program, but we have a fiduciary duty and responsibility to find out where the fund is going, how the program effectively is running. And so that is my proposal at this time, Madam Chair.
Is there any objection to that? Okay. Then, Mr. Minister, you've made a comment. You've made a notation to that effect, and that's what we'll do. So with that, let's move forward into the subject matter of today's gathering. Thank you very much, agency folks. One thing, panel, before we start with invited testimony from Mr. Reagan, who is the chair of the International Trade Commission, at the end of today's committee, Co-Chair Lim is going to make a proposal to all of us that we sign a joint letter to legislative leadership. We've discussed this before, but he has a specific proposal to recommend the reinstitution of a joint trade and economic development committee as a standing committee for the 2007 session. And I just would like you to keep that in the back of your mind as we hear these very thoughtful presentations about what the state is doing with respect to international trade. I personally think the concept of a joint committee is one where the House and the Senate, Republican and Democrat alike, can share information in perhaps a more streamlined way, and we avoid these communication gaps that have just been demonstrated here today. So we'll take that up at the very end of the presentations that we hear. I'd just like you to have it in the back of your mind as you hear the presentations. And with that, Mr. Reagan, thank you for joining us. If you'd come forward with your testimony, we'd appreciate it. Thank you very much for coming today.
Thank you very much for asking me. Appreciate the chance to talk to you and for the opportunity of discussing with you the role and activities of the International Trade Commission. I would like to very quickly discuss three topics. First, the importance of international commerce to Oregon's economy. Second, the history of the International Trade Commission, or as we call it, the ITC, and its activities. And third, the role of the ITC in the future. I realize that to some extent I'm speaking to the choir here, but it's surprising to the members of the ITC that relatively few people in the state of Oregon, including not enough of our legislators, recognize what a key element international trade is in Oregon's economy. One out of four of all Oregon jobs is linked to export. One out of five manufacturing jobs is related to export. Oregon consistently ranks among the top 10 U.S. states in exports on a per capita basis and is 20% above the U.S. per capita average. More than 150 foreign companies have operations in Oregon, and they employ more than 20,000 Oregonians. After several years of slowdown, interest in foreign direct investment in the U.S. and in Oregon is again on the rise. The international marketplace is of major importance to the promotion and growth of Oregon's economy, and that means the economy of all Oregonians, including job creation, personal income, and the public services that result from jobs, taxes, and revenues to the state. It seems to us that the manner in which Oregon promotes the growth of its international commerce, therefore, and the tools made available to those in the international department, whose job it is to undertake that promotion, should be a matter of great interest and hopefully concern for all of the political leaders of this state. Approximately 60% of Oregon's exports go to Asia, where we have a clear geographical advantage. Yet we're only slightly known in China, due at least in part to the lack of a focused and effective effort to promote our areas of economic expertise there. In my personal view, unless we commit the time, effort, and funds now, we will fail to take advantage of what is rapidly becoming the next major opportunity, India. In 1995, the Oregon legislature authorized the creation of the International Trade Commission. It is appointed by the governor to serve as advisor to the governor with respect to policies and strategies for Oregon's involvement in international commerce. To be honest, it has never been very clear what the commission can or is expected to do and how that, whatever that is to be accomplished. Without some specific instructions or authority or duties, an advisory commission is a pretty nebulous entity. Until recently, there has been an international division within the OECD, and the Commission has worked with that division to develop strategies for promoting both exports of Oregon-produced products and methods of encouraging investment into Oregon by foreign industries. The Commission's formal mission statement is, develop policies that further Oregon's competitiveness in international commerce, advocate and promote the state's international agenda. Without spending time describing how the International Division has been organized and how it has operated until very recently, let me simply say that the current commission soon realized after its appointment that the organization of the division was not as effective as it could be, largely because those holding the foreign desks in Portland and those in foreign offices or serving as foreign representatives were trying, in effect, to be everything to everyone, helping startups and established businesses and everybody in between in the broadest range of efforts. We also realize that given the very limited funds available, It was impossible for the division to carry out all of those activities in an effective and productive manner. We concluded that the division needed to focus on a more limited number of activities, which meant, in turn, focusing more heavily with respect to both exports and investment on those industry clusters that have the greatest potential to promote Oregon's economy and to be an effective force in the global marketplace. That does not mean that help on a more local level would cease, but simply that there would be a greater degree of focus. The Commission commenced the formulation of what it has referred to as the new strategic plan. The plan was intended to draw the division's focus into a limited number of high-potential industries, while also focusing the division's greatest efforts in those geographical areas where the high-potential industries have the greatest likelihood of being economically successful and providing the highest growth. Due to a number of changes in the international division, a change of the division itself into more or less a department within the Business and Investment Division, and an organizational reshuffling of the OECDD, development of the new plan, which had been effectively taken over by the staff, was significantly slowed down. It is now expected to be in full operation by next September, about 9 months later than the Commission had originally planned and hoped. There have been some recent encouraging developments. Karen Godden has recently been selected to fill the new post of Export Manager. We're excited about that. Procedures are underway for the selection of an investment manager and also new industry cluster experts in the Portland office. There will follow decisions regarding the geographical areas of the world where Oregon's clusters have the greatest potential, and that, of course,
Mr.
will provide direction.
May I interrupt you?
Yeah.
I'm going to excuse myself from the remainder of the meeting. I have just been notified of a death in our family, and I need to excuse myself, and so with your permission, I will do so.
Who is your family member?
My husband's brother. So if you would excuse me.
There will follow decisions regarding the geographical areas of the world where Oregon's clusters have the greatest potential, and that, of course, will provide direction as to how to prioritize expenditures in those marketplaces. It has become obvious to the Commission that one of the greatest needs is the education of more Oregonians as to the role international commerce plays in our and their economy. It is a role that is so significant that, at least in our view, it needs and deserves greater attention and greater support from the state administration, regardless of party, and from both houses of the legislature. Those in the international area of the OECDD also need to develop a means of better communicating with the legislators, the administration, and the residents of this state as to the effectiveness of their efforts, the many successes that they have had and will continue to have, and the meaning of those successes to all of us. Those communication efforts are currently under serious study and consideration. With respect to the Commission itself, it has very kindly been granted an opportunity by the administration to draft its own charge from the governor. Doesn't mean it will be followed, but we can draft it. And to state what it believes it can most effectively accomplish, what responsibilities should be entrusted to us, how it needs to be empowered to successfully accomplish those responsibilities, and any activities that the responsibilities entail. In the process of considering these matters, we are only in the early stages of doing so. The Commission is looking at two scenarios, and there well may be others to study before we are ready to respond to the administration's offer. One scenario is to significantly increase the role and responsibility of the Commission, raising it above a purely advisory entity, the one where the skills of its members can be used and its members can feel that they are making a more meaningful contribution to the state. This could and most likely should involve a number of different things, such as having the international effort returned to a divisional status with its own line-item budget, giving the Commission oversight responsibility over budget expenditures, asking the Commission to provide periodic bullet points of key international economic issues to the governor and the legislature, and giving the chairman of the Commission direct contact with the governor and the governor's staff. Such a role for the Commission would necessarily require it to formulate separate and clear goals, assume some oversight responsibility with respect to hiring and terminating of key division personnel, and assume a more active role in the activities of both the governor and the administration as they relate to international commerce. The alternative scenario under consideration would be to recommend that the commission be discontinued, and that someone with recognized expertise in international trade matters be added to the OECDC to help it focus on that portion of its oversight with regard to the international efforts of the OECDD. It's not too clear to us yet how that could be effectively accomplished. Either change, however, and particularly the latter, would also necessitate the staff of the OECDD being clearly directed to more actively assume such matters as improved communication concerning international commerce and its importance to Oregon with the legislature, the administration, and Oregonians generally. Speaking for myself only, and without making any assumptions as to what decisions or recommendations the Commission may ultimately make, I am convinced that a continuation of the Commission in its present status, with no one really reporting to it, no clear responsibilities, and few, if any, requests for advice or the use of the expertise of its members, will not lead to a viable Commission in the future. The bottom line is that for the good of Oregon, changes must be made in the way international commerce and Oregon's response to it are undertaken. The opportunities are there. They will belong to those who take advantage of them. And that requires proper organization, adequate funding, committed and knowledgeable staff, cooperation among all of the relevant Oregon agencies, a commitment by the administration and the legislature, and closer teamwork between those working in the international department and those in the private sector whose economic future is intimately tied to the global marketplace. Oregon needs to stop reacting, usually too late, and needs to commit greater efforts and funds in proactive, foot-in-the-door activities with the greatest potential for future trade growth, including export, import, and foreign direct investment into Oregon, exists. It is essential that Oregon step up to the challenge in a more focused and aggressive manner, or we surely will fall behind the states who understand the importance of international trade to their future. Thank you very much.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Tomei.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Reagan, thank you for your testimony. Could you tell us how many people are on your commission?
The commission was increased about 2.5 years ago by the governor. And I think there are, counting one representative and one member of the Senate, 17. I should add that it's an unusually competent group of people with an unusually high degree of expertise and experience dealing in international affairs. Almost everybody on the commission has traveled throughout the world extensively for their industry, their companies. It's the president of Fred Meyer, and it's a very high-level group of folks for the most part. And that's good and bad, because the good is they know what they're doing. If somebody asks them to do something, they can be of great help. The bad is they're very busy folks, and if they're not doing something meaningful, they're not going to take the time away from their other activities. And the way things are currently designed, they're not being asked to do anything very meaningful.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, may I follow up? A couple of questions. Do you have paid staff, Mr. Reagan?
Pardon?
Does the commission have paid staff?
Do we
have paid staff? Are you assigned staff to work with the commission?
We work with... how do I put it? It's kind of a, this is maybe the way to describe it. I'm kind of interested in this. Maybe make some sharp with your hand, because you'll notice that there's no International Trade Commission on anywhere. And we work with, in a way, with all of these folks, but, and they all work with us, and they help. We work very closely from time to time with Mike, and that we are with Salzgiver, Mr. Aaron Godden, and, but we have some members of, we don't have any staff assigned to us directly, but we do have the use of certain members of the staff who are
for the most part, doing some of his other tasks as well.
And how often do you meet?
Well, we meet regularly, every 3 months. Okay. But we've met quite a number of times on an interim basis as well.
Okay. And the last question, if I may, Mr. Chair. Thank you. Have you shared your concerns with the governor and all his staff?
Yes, and it was a result of some recent conversation with Pat Egan that we were... It was suggested to us that we should draft our own charge from the governor. And I find that we're very appreciative to Pat for making that proposal to us.
Great. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative Boyle.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Reagan, again, when and how and by whom was the commission created? Earlier in your testimony, you had said when and how it was created.
Well, it's when and how were it created? It was created in 1995. Those of us on it have only been on a couple of years.
Is it a statutory?
I don't know if it's a statutory creation or not.
Is it created by statute?
Created by statute.
All right. And so apparently we may need to call someone else up because the statute obviously doesn't have any of these parameters and mission statements and things that Mr. Reagan's referring to.
There's nothing specific other than this general, the kind of generalities that I've mentioned today.
Okay. And I, too, as you were talking, I pulled out the organization chart, too, because I wanted to see where this division was you were referring to, and I presume you're talking about the one labeled Business and Trade Development Division on here, which has international listed underneath it.
Is that right? That's, I don't want to be too familiar with Mike next to me to talk about this, but it was at one time a separate division with its own director, and Mike Doyle, and Mike left about a year and a half ago, and these changes occurred, and it was brought under Business and Trade Development Division as part of this new organization.
Okay. Just one or two more. Now, the OECDD has its own commission, correct?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Burley, yes. What is not on this organizational chart, but which is on, for the record, Mike Salzger, the Deputy Director, what is not on this chart, but which is on other versions of it, is a box that shows the eight councils and commissions which we support. And that is, we have the Economic Development Commission, the International Trade Commission, the Oregon Telecommunications Coordinating Council, the Oregon Innovation Council, the Governor's Small Business Council. So the list is rather extensive.
Well, Mr. Reagan, has your commission, the International Trade Commission, ever had joint meetings or hearings or whatever the case may be with the OECDD's commission?
I've met with Raleigh, and we made a presentation to their commission meeting in Tuesday, 2 or 4 weeks ago. But to answer you more directly, we have not had probably as regular communications with them as we should have.
Mr. Chair, just an observation, if I may. In my rather limited time in the legislature so far, one of the things that's become readily apparent to me is we have a proliferation of councils and commissions, and it doesn't matter if it's your department or any other department. And, in fact, last session, I know in a couple of the substantive committees I served on, we had requests for even more of them. And I hope in your statutory review, this is one of the things you're taking a look at, because it seems to me, Mr. Reagan, that it would be rather fruitless to be having all these meetings when you've got no real input, control, whatever the case, however you want to describe that, over anything. You've got a division here buried down in a department, and you're out here having these meetings with all these experts, and what's the net effect?
Well, there have been other activities in which we've been engaged. We started off when we first began with some workforces, and we looked at four or five different areas within the state where we felt that changes needed to be made or some kind of encouragement needed to be given either to the state or to sometimes even the federal authorities in ways that would help international trade within our state. Some of them had to do with transportation, some of them had to do with education. But it's very difficult for a commission like ours. I mean, we can write a letter and hope that somebody reads it, but it's pretty difficult to have much of a useful effect under those circumstances. And that's but when that time was over, then that's we saw how, if I can put it this way, how relatively ineffective we were and how little we could accomplish. That's when we decided that there should be a new strategic plan, and we should not only should we be involved in a different way, but we felt that in respect to the international area that the OECDD could be reorganized somewhat and be more effective as well.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, if I might, with some recent history too, I think it helps with the perspective of why we landed on the organizational structure that we did. When I assumed the role of acting director in July of last year, it was clear to me that one of the challenges we had in front of us was to try to manage a fairly large portfolio of issues with a rapidly reduced headcount. I mentioned in my earlier comments, our headcount has shrunk significantly in the last few years. Since 2001, our headcount has gone from 167 FTE to 107. And so we experienced a rather dramatic decrease in personnel to support an expanded portfolio. We had two major new initiatives added to our roles of responsibility. One was the Certified Industrial Land Program, and the second one was the Governor's Innovation Initiative. And we were asked to do that with 60 fewer people. So one of the things, and also in the context of business development theory, we had a number of discussions internally and with other stakeholders, and given the fact that we were not going to get more resources from the legislature at that time, and we were being asked to demonstrate the ability to do well, accomplish well what we were asked to do with the resources that we had, we came up with the organizational structure that we did. One of the feedback items we had heard internally and from our key stakeholders externally was that the agency was highly siloed. And as a result, we combined a number of divisions that were separate. It also allowed us, frankly, to reduce budget impact on us by not having to backfill a number of more highly paid manager positions. We were able to reduce 1, 2, 3 PEMF positions. And so also we felt very strongly that with our primary mission being to advance the economy and to develop and drive business development, which in a global economic environment requires us to do it anywhere on earth, having a separate international division, we wanted to continue to call out the importance of international trade development, but also make it clear that it was related to business development. And so that's one of the reasons that we landed on the structure that we did. We have never said it's permanent. It was simply what we could do with the resources we had to rebuild our credibility with our key stakeholders and with this body, frankly.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. It seems in the last session I heard that when Mr. Bradley was there, you did some performance-based or zero-based budgeting. Did that actually occur, and did you take into consideration, you know, the international trade is probably a pretty significant aspect of that. Was that done?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Nelson, I wouldn't call it exactly zero-based budgeting. I wasn't here for the development of the budget in the beginning of the 05 session, 05-07 biennium, but I would have to say the practical effect is yes, it was effectively, there was a modification of current service level and zero-based budgeting. We looked at what we had, we did not just add more to it, and we, based on the priorities that were set and which our commission now has reviewed and adopted, we
allocated the resources necessary to get that done. We are also within the Internet or the Business and Trade Development Division restructuring the roles even more to realign to support the cluster part of our economic development strategy, which is also in alignment with the Oregon Business Plan. So we're just trying to bring all of these things into synchronicity, if you will, and the budget reflects that.
I want to be sure to emphasize that we empathize with the problems that Mike has had and OECD has had. It's, we're kind of complaining, but not totally complaining, because we understand how difficult it is for them as well as for us.
I have to say, we wouldn't have been able to do what we did without the Commission's active involvement in developing the part of the strategic plan. It was essential to us.
Just to follow that, I mean, it seems to me is that the state is still going to be strapped for money. We really have to put things in a priority list, and I think the testimony of Mr. Rubin is that India, China, international, 1 out of 4 jobs, I mean, that's got to be a priority for us, and for Oregon to succeed. I mean, we're a very small state in population in that respect. I'm thinking, you know, is that, it seems to me, why isn't it up there higher and saying, this is where we really ought to go with this thing?
Well, Mr. Chairman, if you look at the org chart again, there's kind of a flow of activity that will, from the right to the left, if you will. What we're envisioning, if this works out right, is the Innovation and Economic Strategies Division being the gatherer of data, the analyzer of data, the people that tell us the so what. So what's all that data mean? Working in concert with the state economist, working in concert with the legislative fiscal office, with the employment department, working with members of the private sector and the university system to really gather hardcore economic data and help us understand what it means. That's one thing. Second thing is with the Innovation Council, the innovation side of that division, what we expect to see happen then is the development of business development strategies that are then sent over to the Business and Trade Development Division that are then put into practice. So we also have not only the people there here in Oregon, which will be hired here shortly, Karen Bowden, our new international acting business and trade development division manager, will be moving through the next 45 to 60 days and hiring 4 new cluster trade specialists based here in the United States, working in concert with our foreign office representatives and with our business development officer team to put those development practices into effect. So that's the theory, and we'll see if it happens. Now our job is to make reality fit into theory.
Okay, and Ron, thank you very much for coming and your service. We want you to know that we appreciate very much.
Thank you for the opportunity.
And then I have a couple of questions before you go.
And you are Kamsamida.
I have a couple of questions. I have a couple of questions.
Sorry, I was trying to get out of here. I've had your questions before.
And you mentioned that the role of increased responsibility. You also mentioned that the divisional status of the international trade and also direct contact with governors might help. And also, if it's not effective, it's another option is to discontinue of this agency. And so, you talked about the adequate fundings and the staff and the cooperation and then teamwork with the private and public, and that was a real good thing to say. As you're saying that, before I ask a question, is this an organizational chart? Is this current? Or is this a proposal? What is that?
Mr. Chairman, that is the current organizational chart. We are operating under that right now.
Okay. And then in relation to this one, where the International Trade Commission stands?
The International Trade Commission is, as I mentioned, sir, one of the eight councils and commissions that we support. If you were to put them on the organizational chart, I would put it the governor, the councils and commissions, and then the director in that order. We support them either through statute or by direction of the governor. And so the support for that, the International Trade Commission, comes out of the Business and Trade Division. And we have currently the director or the manager of that division and one of our senior staff, Craig Burke, both are very active in supporting the commission.
Okay.
And Ron, do you appear on what is a board and she will be doing that?
Okay. And Ron, do you, what is your assessment or opinion on this, the chart, especially international trade, international under business and trade development division? What is your opinion on this one?
Well, I'm not. I'm not so concerned about the chart. And frankly, one thing I really want to be certain that you understand, none of us on the commission is particularly concerned about the commission. We're not concerned about the commission as a commission. We're concerned about what we think ought to be a greater recognition of the importance of international trade and whatever it takes to accomplish that for the good of the state. That's the goal. And whether we continue where we are on a chart, anything. Those things are not important to us. But we do feel very strongly, based largely upon our own involvement, most of us for quite a few years, in international commerce in one way or another, and the knowledge of the important role it plays in the state, we feel that there is both opportunity for tremendous growth, and it's very important to the state that the whole state recognize that and the folks who are working that area be supported so that they can take full advantage of it. So I don't want anyone to think that this was probably a poor way to show it, but that we're upset about not having been on this chart. We are on this chart, went on down a ways. We would be on here over in the side somewhere, but that's not our concern. Our concern is if we can play a role to help international trade in this state, we'll play it. If we can't, then there's no need for us. And it's as simple as that. And it's not entirely up to us as to what that role ought to be or how it can be most effectively played. But that's one of the things that we're trying to look at ourselves right now.
Okay. After having said that, I'd like to see any specific proposal. How could we get to that goal? Do you have anything in mind so we can introduce legislation in this coming session?
Not at this time. It's only been like 3 weeks since we were asked to do this. We have had two meetings, a small group of the commission.
Okay.
Because we haven't had a commission meeting to discuss this subject, and we will have more, and we will have more with the entire commission. We will have a proposal one way or the other, and we'll have it to you in the not too distant future, but we're not ready for anything yet with any early stages.
Okay. As myself, as chair of this House Committee on Trade, I'd like to see the international trade be increased, and with more responsibility, and hopefully that the appropriate adequate fundings to get the job done, because international trade in this environment is very, very important. Already you suggested that the many jobs associated with the international trade and the presence more than 150 foreign companies in our state. And this is a big winner for the state. I like to see the presence of the international trade division or commission, whatever, that I like to see that move ahead in the future. So if you give us some ideas on how could we get there with the consultation with the OECD or Mike or anyone else, please let us know so we can stop drafting the legislation on that issue. I do appreciate that.
We'll do that. I want to be certain that you realize also that we do recognize that international trade is just one segment of this whole picture of business development. Internationally, throughout the United States, imports, exports, investment, we're not, I would be surprised if we came up with something that called for us to be an independent commission, because we're really part of this whole program of economic development, and I think we certainly know that we have to be viewed that way. So, but the key from our standpoint is trying to find a role for us within that bigger picture where we can play, make some significant contributions to the state and through helping with international trade. That's what we're aiming for.
Okay. Thank you very much. Any other questions? Representative Harvey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate, Mr. Reagan, your testimony, and it's very provoking. I was just hoping that the chair could get to staff so we could have a copy of your testimony.
Yes.
Perhaps just, it was a lot to take in listening to you. You had a lot of statements there that were very thought-provoking. And just one more comment, Mr. Chair.
Okay.
You know, I'm kind of recognizing what you're doing, and I guess I'd sort of like to know what your commission feels is the purpose of your commission. You know, because international trade is regulated by the federal government pretty much, as far as I know, and wondering how the state legislature can affect that federal policy is kind of an interesting idea. And I recognize also that perhaps your purpose is to go out and promote more trade out in the global community. And so I'm just kind of curious as to hearing what the commission really feels their purpose ought to be in bringing trade to the state and promoting our economy, and whether any of that involves policy, and because sometimes trade may not be necessarily a good thing for the state of Oregon. I say that guardedly, but I'm thinking specifically of the Canadian softwood lumber agreement, where we import a tremendous amount of timber or lumber products as such, and we can't compete with the Canadian lumber because it's subsidized by their government, and it's not exactly a fair trade scenario. So promoting that doesn't seem like really a good idea to me. So I'm just kind of curious how your commission would play in promoting policies at the federal level that seem to have a negative impact on us as well.
On the federal level? Well, it's a difficult thing for us to have much influence on the federal level, but you know, for instance, we took a position in support of the deepening of the channel, and we let that be, we advertised that with our senators and our congressmen and so forth. We've done various things with respect to transportation, but it's true that the federal government regulates in some ways international trade, but we're not as much involved with the regulations, which is really something pretty much beyond our control. We're more concerned about one way or another helping individual companies who are trying to get started in finding the right parties to do business with in Asia or in Europe, or finding companies that are interested in moving someplace and being certain that they come and look at Oregon to put their plant, using our contacts to hopefully and get early leads with respect to things that can result in whether it's a it can be a joint venture, it could be a plan here, it could be some kind any kind of business relationship. That's the kind of thing in which we're more involved. We really are not in a position to have much influence on the kinds of things that the federal government regulates. And that's really not, to the extent that we can take a position and maybe interest one of us or some of us knows Gordon Smith or somebody, Ron Wyden or somebody, and can communicate with them. And if something that's important, we do that. But the great bulk of what we see as our role is helping Oregon companies find ways in which to either start or expand their international commerce, find companies that are interested in coming to Oregon, and then doing whatever we can to support the folks in Oregon who are trying to encourage them to come here instead of to Washington or Idaho or some other place.
All right. Any other questions? All right. Thank you very much for coming, and we'll talk more.
A pleasure.
Okay.
Thank you.
Mike, before you go, and what's the plan for the International Trade Office, especially in Asia?
Mr. Chairman,
in this organizational chart.
Mr. Chairman, members of the Commission, we, or the committee, we have just last year former Director Brantley and Chair Reagan met with each of the Foreign Office representatives and did basically an operations review with each one of them. And we have, during that period of review, we were moving, we moved to a month-to-month level of contracting relationship. I think what I'll do is turn it over to Karen Godden, if I can, Mr. Chairman, to give a more detailed response to that. But we have met, we had our commission, Economic Development Commission meeting, as you know, in Coos Bay several weeks ago, and all of the Foreign Office representatives came to the United States and presented to the commission a general overview of their work plan and their results for the last year. And I think now as we move forward in organizing the international section of the Business and Trade Development Division, what you're going to see is the hiring of these cluster trade specialists, the embedding of contracts, contract relationships with China, with Japan, with Korea, with Europe. And you're going to see us focus more, and that's at the direction of the commission to provide that kind of focus. And
then month by month at this time.
Well, we are now moving to longer term contracts. We did the month by month simply to manage that review period.
Okay. Well, we need to intervene at this time. Our member of Representative Richardson, and he's going to join us at this time, and we were going to call him about 2:15, but it's about 2:35, so if you bear with us, I do appreciate it.
Oh,
thank you,
sir.
This is John Lynn here, Chair.
Hello.
Well, welcome joining us in this teleconversation. And I understand you have something to share with us. And could you say at this time?
Yes, can you hear me all right?
We are hearing all right.
Very good.
All right.
First, by way of background, President CBOT is the legislative transmission to China, which begins next week. And by way of background, I want to just say that in 1984, Oregon signed sister state accord by our then governor, Dick Tito, with the Fujian province of the People's Republic of China for the greater part of the 1980s and 90s, the relationship that we had with Fujian kept dormant. But in the past 4 years, Oregon has made a concerted effort to renew and strengthen Oregon's relationship with its sister state in Fujian. One step that was taken was to lessen our dependence of our legislature on making these, in continuing this relationship. We have legislators that come and go, and so there will be emphasis placed on renewing communications and then nothing for years. And so 2004, we created the Oregon Fujian Sister State Association, which is a nonprofit corporation. It's primarily made up of members of the Portland. The OFSSA, as it's called, has, as its honorary chairman, past Governor Vicatia. It has about 17 legislators, past legislators, on its panel of honorary advisory on its board. The directors, the board of directors for OFSSA, is primarily composed of Portland Chinese American business leaders who have a great love for the Fujian region and Fujian people. Now, recently, the Senate President and the Speaker of the House have created, and our co-chair, the Joint Committee on Fujian Sister States. The members of the association, the OFSSA, their board of directors are named as members of this legislative joint committee. As a result of and to honor the creation of this joint committee on Fujian Sister States, Fujian government leaders invited the Senate President and the Speaker of the House to lead a state delegation to Fujian in June. And because of a number of reasons, neither were able to attend, and so they asked for me to lead a delegation to go to Fujian province to accomplish several goals while we're there. And along with me from the legislature is also Representative Dalto and Senator Beyer. In addition to the three of us, there's probably about 15 members of the delegation, which includes several, I think seven or eight businessmen from Portland, as well as the board of directors from the association, and others that are despite the intent. Anyway, so we're leaving next week to make this trip to Fujian Province. And while we're there, we hope to accomplish a couple of very important things. One is, the Oregon Fujian Sister State Association is opening a business office in the capital city of Fujian. And that is a huge, huge benefit for Oregon, because there's no other state that has an office, that has a representative or an office of concerned people for the state that are going to promote the interaction and develop a relationship such as education, tourism, manufacturing, investment, like we will have with the Oregon Fujian Sister State Association in Fujian, which is the capital city of Fujian province. Now, the OFSSA establishing province is not being funded or affiliated with the state of Oregon. It's being done because the OFSSA wants to promote relationships between Oregon and Fujian. And it's just being very well received by the Fujian government and their Chamber of Commerce and many, many very interested investors and businessmen who would like to bring money and get involved in investing in America. And we're saying, come to America, come to Oregon. So that's part of what we'll be doing while we're there. We'll also be meeting with leaders from the Fujian government and accepting their congratulations for establishing our joint committee and just reestablishing and re-strengthening the relationship that Oregon has with Fujian and helping to show that the Oregon government supports business interactions between Oregon businesses with those in Fujian. That's so important to aware, because if you're in business in China, you want to make sure that you've got the government's nod or their approval for your business, or else you can find yourself in difficulty. So with that kind of environment, when they're going to do partnerships or do business in another country, they would like to ensure that the business, you know, would also have a certain relationship with the government in the other country, because they know how important that is in China. And so for Oregon to make this additional trade mission over to China and be able to partner with some of the businesses in meetings and show and make interventions and help kind of promote the relationship, it shows a relationship between government and business in Oregon that is a lot of kind of, it gives a lot of respect and is very important to the people that are doing
All right. Well, thank you very much for the report, and then we appreciate your willingness to go to China in your own funds. and plus other members, and please give our best regards and thank them for us. Okay, and then let me see exactly when are you going next week?
Our flight leaves on the 14th, which is next Wednesday, and we've been receiving tremendous support from the OECD and from Pratt of Oregon. They have put together materials for us to use at a Zoom group. There's going to be an exposition while we're there, and there'll be people from all over the region, in fact, from all over China, and so Oregon will have its own booth. And we will have posters and handouts and flyers, and we will be promoting Oregon business, investment, and tourism. It may not be brilliant, but in 1995, there were 4.5 million Chinese who traveled abroad, but in last year, 2005, it was 31 million. And by 2010, they expect 60 million Chinese tourists to go internationally, and one of the top six destinations is America. And so our message is, come to America, come to Oregon. Come to Oregon and see the real America, have the real American adventures, and buy American souvenirs tax-free.
All right. Be a good salesman over there for us.
Thank you.
Okay, and then we need to thank also the former Senator Mei Yi, who has linked between our state and Fujian province. I think she's the godmother of this sister state relationship.
Yes, she is alive and well.
Okay, can I suggest one thing though? That since you already formed or are forming a Fujian-Oregon sister state relationship, that my suggestion, my thought is instead of building each country that the sister country, I'm considering that we are all sister state community in our in our state, so one country can look after China and Korea. We have Cheongnam-do, a sister state. Japan, we have Toyama, and plus any other countries. So I think it's something that while you are traveling, look into that matter, whether we can get all combined together under one committee instead of each different committee forming their own committee.
Certainly, that would be more efficient if we can do it in a way that it doesn't dilute the ability to get anything done.
Exactly. Okay. Any other suggestions? Okay, and well done, and bon voyage.
Thank you.
And when you come back, we'd like to hear from you also.
I'd be happy to come back and report.
Thank you very much. God bless. All right, so, okay. Thank you for the interruption. Appreciate it. Let's go ahead. Next one. Okay. Karen, what do you have in mind?
Well, first, good morning. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Yeah. For the record, my name is Karen Godden. I'm the International Trade Manager. We're at the OECD, the Oregon Economic and Community Development with the State of Oregon, officially for the record. I'm delighted to be here today. I wanted to make sure that I came and told you that I have been before several committees here in previous capacities. I am no stranger to international trade and working with the private sector, with the legislature. And in my written remarks, I have outlined a number of those things that I have done. I thought it would be appropriate, quite frankly, to introduce myself in this regard. And with that in mind, I'll just go ahead, just given the time that we really need to get to the issue at hand, and that is where the international trade team is headed on the implementation of our international business strategy.
I will leave it to the record to note that I have both worked with private sector groups, regional groups, as well as even at the federal level on identifying international trade issues. In particular, I would like to note that I've been in the trenches basically working with companies who face global competitive issues, but I've also been engaged at the government level and know the important role that the government plays in promoting international trade. Mr. Reagan, I think he was quite modest. I told him that I thought that the International Trade Commission had really been instrumental in getting the department and being a voice and an advocate for many of us who have long been involved in international trade, both to get the department resources and focus to where we thought we could help be more competitive, and I think his committee is due a great thanks for that. But also, I know you all understand the importance of trade, but many Americans and Oregonians do not. And there's been some discussion already about the reorganization and the consolidation, if you will, of the international trade component piece in with the business development piece. And I, for one, am happy for the integration of that focus, in part because I think in terms of international trade, many people think of international trade and probably more as an export that you put in a box and you send somewhere. I don't think people understand that really that we're talking about international business and the complexities of what's involved in that. And as a result, I think the department did need, and we are moving forward with our plans to restructure more less of a country desk model here in Oregon, more to a cluster approach where we really need to look at how we can get companies to work together and identify and focus our efforts in that regard. And I think that is the nature of how business is being conducted. So I'm happy to be part of the team that's implementing that. It's been mentioned that we will be hiring international trade cluster specialists in the coming 45-60 days, which is a key part of our efforts to promote exports and investment. We are looking at the hire of a global investment manager and coordinating through the department our efforts on the promotion of export and investments. And I think many of you are familiar with the key clusters that we have identified, in part because this is a new model and we wanted to give emphasis to those areas that we thought had already demonstrated some international market development, which would be high tech, sustainable technologies, energy efficiencies, environmental technologies, green buildings, bioscience, medical technologies, primary and secondary wood products. It's also been mentioned, while we are giving focus to these cluster areas, this does not mean that we will not be working with companies that lie outside of this area. I think our focus will be more to assist them in identifying resources and others who may be better prepared to service their needs. I would note for the record a very careful handoff on that effort. I think probably at the heart of what people would like to know about our strategy is both our efforts to identify the services that we can provide to help our companies, and also something that I believe just in the 3 weeks that I've been at the department, our marketing promotion materials and other things that we do not readily have available in the way that we need to. And we will
be pushing ahead to develop those and using those. Our international trade cluster specialist will be doing more outreach, I think, than our previous structure has encouraged or allowed. And with that in mind, we have put in place some trade services and efforts to work with industry associations, small business organizations, certainly our colleagues within the state of Oregon, Department of Ag, Port of Portland, and others that we have a long history of working with in promoting international trade in this regard. I will be talking a little bit later to brief you on the governor's trade mission to Korea and Japan, but I think I'll take that opportunity just to note that missions headed by the governor and senior elected officials are very important in promoting business ties and relationships overseas. And we are honored to be working on that and feel that that really brings together and demonstrates quite well what we have done through our reorganization of combining both exports and an investment strategy for international business. We are looking also at leveraging events that will maximize our potential to promote and raise the profile of Oregon. We have a Oregon Global Reach video and soon to be developed marketing brochures to help with the promotion in international trade. And, of course, our trade specialists, our cluster specialists, will be working to also advance the Port of Portland as both an import and an export destination center and our distribution center strategies as well. As we talked about the importance of a foreign direct investment, or FDI, strategy for the department, we have identified some target markets for our use in identifying where we should be possibly looking at contract relations in this area, expanding the scope of some existing relationships. Certainly Germany, the UK, Japan, Korea are areas where we have representation and China, but we really feel like we should be doing more to promote inward investment to Oregon through the use of these relationships as well. I know one of the important issues at hand is really the measurement, the metric of the success of these efforts. And to date, the organization has used foreign export sales, counseling sessions, and even testimonials primarily to evaluate its success in helping the international trade community. Over the coming months, I will be working on developing with staff and others on additional benchmarks and metrics that I think will help us ensure that we are meeting the goals that we have set out and what we hope to achieve by restructuring the organization to really be responsive to the international business needs and figuring out how, I think it was stated earlier, maybe not just measuring the output, but the outcomes of what is involved. And while at times it can be difficult to figure out what these exact metrics are because of the nature of international trade, many transactions start, and it may be a year or two out before, I'm confident that we will be able to develop that side. That certainly is under discussion. For now, I think it's best that I just thank you for the opportunity to come before you introduce myself. I think many of you are familiar, certainly from earlier presentations on the efforts underway to both restructure, focus along cluster lines, which I think gets more of an international business strategy and assistance, both to identify the clients and companies we need to be working with. It allows for greater cooperation, certainly with people involved in the trade arena. And I look forward to comments and any feedback and your questions.
Okay. Any questions? Let's go to the representing Tomei.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for your testimony, Ms. Godden. Maybe I'm missing. I don't see India on the top export partners.
India has not been identified as our top export market. It's an area, I think, of exploration for us. There is a lot of discussion about India being a growing and rapidly expanding market. We know that we want to lead with where we have a strength already as we explore those opportunities. So I think India is one that we will be looking at as we figure out how best to address that market based on our cluster strategies.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Thatcher.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Kind of scanning, you weren't reading it, so I was just kind of scanning it as you were giving us your testimony. And it says in here, the international division has selected a few clusters because of their international potential, mm-hmm. both for exports and foreign investments. How has the international division honed in or zeroed in on these particular clusters? The reason I'm asking is I don't see agriculture in here at all. We've got wine growers. I mean, my district has Yamhill County. We've got nurseries, we've got hazelnuts. I don't see that in there. Yeah. Why?
Thank you. On the agricultural side, the Oregon Department of Agriculture has a well-established program and does work with a number of agricultural products. In terms of nurseries and others, you're right, there is a lot of trade. In fact, in the trade stats, you'll see that exports to Asia in particular is demonstrated there. I can't say 100% why that wasn't given a higher priority other than I think it's probably one of those areas where we had to set some boundaries, and I may defer to my colleagues. But part of, to answer the broader part of your question, we have a track record in these areas. We have success helping companies, and we think that we could even do more with a stronger focus. They also are targeted areas where we see growth potential out in the global marketplace, and I think that's probably the primary reasons why these were given as strong a focus and priority as they are. So,
Mr. Chairman, if I might, Chairman, Representative Thatcher, from a macro perspective, the clusters that the department has begun to zero in on, if you look at the Oregon Business Plan, OBC and the business plan partners have identified roughly 40 readily identifiable clusters in Oregon using Joe Courtwright's and Michael Porter's criteria. We do not believe we have the resources to support 40 clusters. We will do our best to support them all in some way or another. The five that really have emerged as the primary ones, that if you follow the 80-20 rule, that being we'll put about 80% of our resources into these top five or six clusters, and the other 20% we'll reserve for trying to help the others as they emerge, are high-tech and software, value-added forest products, sports apparel, food processing, and medical devices. Those are really the areas that we are seeing the highest rate of activity. So food processing, the department has, as a separate department, identified it as an area of focus. The Department of Agriculture really is the owner of that particular area of support, so we will collaborate with them, and we do on an active basis. The other one is tourism, actually, the tourism cluster.
That's the sixth.
Any other questions?
Yes.
Senator Nelson.
Yeah, just a comment, I think, to follow up on the representatives, both of their comments, is that a lot of it is that we constrain ourselves with our, what I guess I call the environmental laws. How are we going to increase our export profile when our paper and wood products are only 2% or 4% when we're not able to go in and use one of our major natural resources? Also, Karen, I was interested, I don't know whether you were involved with the Columbia River Coalition.
Yes.
But, you know, my sense of this whole thing is instead of still using water on the Columbia River, Oregon is going to be just a so-so state. I mean, we're just like a huge resource flowing to the ocean. Bob Hale from my district was in front of the Senate part of this committee a couple weeks ago or a month ago. Basically said he can create and has a business plan for creating a $1 billion industry in Northeast Oregon, but he needs water out of the Columbia River. And the state of Washington is light years ahead of us right now. They've just passed a law. They're going to take some off-channel, off-salmon season reservoirs, create those, and they've committed $200 million to it. So they made a major improvement. And so from my viewpoint, until we as the state of Oregon start making those investments, I mean, even the high tech, how much water does high tech use when they create those chips? They just use a lot of water, don't they?
Actually, it's less than you might think. It's about, Intel, for example, which is what I'm most familiar with, uses about 2% of the water made available by Tualatin Valley Water District, which is where they get their supply, and it's a very steady. And interestingly enough, because of the technology community's value of reducing their impact and use of resources, they've actually stayed very steady at that 2% level while increasing their output. So they're getting better at it. But the water districts love high tech because they're a very predictable customer in terms of their use.
Money, too.
That's right.
And a follow-up, I guess, to that, too, is that, I mean, the population projections for Portland are just huge. I mean, 1 million or 2 million people, something like that. You're going to have further demand and increase of water. I'm going to continue to be after you folks and say, okay, what are we going to do about the Columbia River? How are we going to start using that water? And at some point, I'm probably going to give you a call and say, okay, what do you know? You know, give me some more information on some of this. Cause, and I know it's a very complicated issue, but...
Well, I certainly would be happy. I can't speak to the issue well right at this point, but would be happy to kind of... come back at you a little bit later.
Thank you, that's good.
If only if we can employ some of that innovation and technology to maybe find some additional resources in that area. So, makes sense.
All right. Representative Harvey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was wondering if you could, in primary and secondary wood products, as far as exports, I'm curious if you can tell me what percentage of those exports are raw logs as opposed to products.
Not federal. We don't export federal logs.
Yeah, to be honest, I have to apologize. I don't know what the percentage would be, but I'd be happy to get back to you and answer that. Certainly, I know you want a correct answer, so I'll leave. I know it says here in the Oregon export profile it's roughly 2% wood products, but I don't know how it's broken out. So,
Mr. Chairman, Representative Holby, I do believe there is a continuing ban on the export of federal logs. I don't think state logs are exported, so the rest would be private, and we'll get that data for you.
Okay.
Just another thought about it. You know, so number one export partner is Canada, and that export is really growing huge and large. I know that they're having the 2010 Olympics in Vancouver, BC Winter Olympics. I've just been affiliated with a group called Pacific Northwest Economic Region, which is statutorily created entity with Washington, Oregon, Montana, Idaho, Alaska, and three Canadian provinces. And I would really like to see you folks continue to contact them. I'd be more than willing to make some of those contacts, because they looked down at Oregon and they said, well, why aren't you guys involved with some of the things we're doing up here? And if they're one of our major export people, and in fact, this summer I think I'm going to be able to take a tour of the oil sands of up around Edmonton, which I think, I think those are real answers to a lot of our problems here in the United States.
Senator Nelson, I know when I wore my executive director hat of PNEDA, we did take a very strong regional approach, even beyond Washington and Idaho, and worked. In fact, we had Canadian companies that were members of our organization, and I think those kinds of opportunities and networks are critical. I know in my written testimony I said that I believe that our department needs to collaborate on an economic development model with our regional trade economic development agencies, and I think quite frankly that could involve joint industry-led trade. It'd be nice if we had government-led missions, but I think even from an industry standpoint, we do need to market ourselves as a large regional market, and I think if we look, others have done this successfully, and we don't need to reinvent the wheel. We just need to work with those who probably are out front on it.
Thank you.
Okay, any other questions? If not, then we will move on to the trade mission to Japan and Korea of the governors. And are you going to do that, or do we have anyone from the governor's office?
I apologize. You do have to hear from me one more time.
Okay.
Mr. Egan was unable to come. He had intended to be here up until, I think, around 10:30 today, when something did come up. And I have personally been involved since joining the department.
Okay.
I have been involved in the mission, so I feel confident I can answer and brief you on the mission, the scope, and the plans that are underway, and I'd be happy to do that. And anything that I can't, I certainly will.
Yes, so we'd like to know when this government is going and how long, what's the purpose of the missions, and what he's going to accomplish, and who's going. Any legislators going joining the governor's trip? I was invited, but I'm not able to join him regrettably, but hopefully next time we'll do that. And so give us some the brief description of this governor's trip.
Okay, thank you. The governor and other state delegates and business and education delegates, there are no legislators who are traveling on this mission, will be headed to Korea on June 24th. We'll be spending roughly a day and a half in Korea before departing for Japan, where they will be spending 3 days in Japan. The focus of the trade mission is both on inbound investment that are critical to our cluster economic structures that we're promoting, as well as export opportunities. Korea and Japan are top export, and in fact, Japan a major investor in Oregon. So it was, quite frankly, a pleasure to work on this, especially with my colleagues from the Department of Agriculture, the Port of Portland, in the recruitment side. And we have identified a number of investment meetings, trade meetings, and even several cultural meetings that we're doing in conjunction with the governor and the delegates during this 5-day business trip. It is a rough estimate, but it is our estimate that the meetings, both the investment side, there's a number of retention, possible expansion projects that the governor and will be meeting with company officials, both Oregon and Japanese and Korean officials on. There is some expectation that there could be some signings, or at least future signings, and that could net us upwards of $200 million or more in new investment in Oregon. So we're working hard on those fronts. I also think it's critical that you understand that this is not a group of companies or even officials just out of the Portland metropolitan area. I think there does tend to be at times a little bit more of a narrow focus. This is a statewide effort. We do have representatives, I know from Eugene, the mayor of Springfield, is actually coming, the Eugene, Springfield, Lane County, Southern Oregon, Astoria, Hillsborough, Coos Bay is sending port officials as well. Central Oregon, Tualatin, Salem, Klamath Falls, there are companies that are represented in specific projects, particularly investments and the sale of products, again, in Korea and Japan. So we're looking forward to this being just the beginning of our efforts to promote Oregon. There is certainly a tourism component to this as well, and probably the biggest place for our marketing efforts are at some of the larger reception events, particularly in Japan, where we will have some key people. Rock Ishii will be there, the designer of the Nike golf in Japan. He's well known, as well as here, and does a lot to promote Oregon when people identify it in those lights. So that is some of the highlights of what we have planned. I can follow up. We do have copies of the schedule that are currently marked as confidential, but I'm sure that they could be made available to you so that you would have an idea. We just aren't distributing them to the public at large because of the nature of the business discussions.
Any legislators joining in for this trip?
No, I regret to say that we do not have anyone that will be joining us. We are not taking any press. There are some companies in the region that are joining in. So,
okay, any questions, any comment? And, okay.
Let's start this time, Representative Thatcher. For fairness sake.
Thank you. The companies that are joining with you, were they invited? Were they specifically asked by the governor and the delegation, or were they, how were they chosen to go?
Yeah, thank you. I think the invitations were done in two parts. There were companies that we were aware doing business, having projects, and they were approached about participating and having the governor be part and the discussions on his trip. But a wide range of companies were contacted beyond the scope of the individual investment business projects themselves. We did, of course, tend to focus on some of the clusters, outsource the open source. We have representatives from the open source technology labs who are going, even the university professors. The president of OSU is participating. The University of Oregon is participating. In fact, in Japan, the alumni offices for Portland State, U of O, and OSU, along with Lewis and Clark, have identified graduates, Japanese graduates of these institutions who will be coming. All of the attendees are currently in fairly senior business circles. We wanted to be able to, I guess,
take advantage, develop, use those networks as we continue to promote Oregon and those relationships culturally, but certainly with the business. But there's a wide audience of people. But I think usually if you're familiar with these types of missions, which I'm sure you are, in the end there's a lot of calling because you're looking at certain people that you think will be able to contribute and have business dealings. So I don't know if that answers it adequately or not. And also I know the Department of Agriculture and the Port of Portland were very actively involved in recruiting. The trip itself certainly helps us support Northwest Airlines and the direct flight into Tokyo as well. So it's a combination of factors.
Representative Toner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. How many people will be in this delegation?
We have a total of 52. Not all of the delegates are going to Korea. Roughly about half of that number will be going to Korea, to Seoul first. There will be some other delegates, business that people that will be meeting us there. And I think our total there will be 35 on the ground. For example, Ron Reagan will be in the region on separate business, and he will be joining us. But in Japan, in Tokyo and Toyama, I should give due to Toyama, we have a 15-year anniversary celebration of a sister city relationship with Toyama. The governor will be there. The Toyama government is holding a special reception in honor of the anniversary, and that sums out to be roughly 50 people.
Okay. Since governors, delegates are going to Japan and visiting Toyama, our sister state, do you know the governor going to the Jeollaram-do sister state in Korea?
No, I can tell you that he is not. It is not scheduled on this trip. Korea just being a slightly shorter stop than Japan, I think probably did not allow for all of the opportunities in our relationship to be touched. And I think another issue is two of the major investment and export sales in Korea do involve travel. At least 2 hours outside of Seoul, which also affected a little bit of our planning.
Okay. So my suggestion is that while the governor is in Korea, I hope he can call the Jeollaram-do, the governor, at least connect with him together, even though he's not able to make it at this time. Hopefully he can visit some other time in the future.
Mm-hmm.
If not, maybe one of the governor's staff might be able to visit and say hello. So they might feel offensive that while governor coming there does not have any connection, and that might not be good while in Japan visiting Toyama. So just to keep that in mind as a friendly advice.
Mr. Chairman, I thank you for that. And if I find out that efforts were made to plan it, I will let you know. I'm just not privy to that at this point that we did do that. But by all means, I will act on your friendly advice.
All right. Thank you very much. If there's no questions, then I appreciate your time to come out, testify. And thank you for your work. You are just about a month new now.
Pardon?
And you are in the job about a month now?
Yeah, a little bit short of that.
Okay.
But at some points, I think I've been there even longer.
Okay. Well,
thank you. I look forward to working with you.
God bless you with you and your work.
Thank you.
Thank you. Okay. At this time, I'd like to call the Saint together with the Mr. Bill Wyatt from the Director of Port of Portland, and also the Dalton Hobbs and from the Portland Agriculture Department. Could you come together? Yes. Okay. We intend to adjourn around 4 o'clock. So just to keep that in mind, if you have to go a little longer, that's fine with me, but please keep that in mind. Who is going to go first?
Go ahead.
No,
A before
three.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, I'm Dalton Hobbs, the Assistant Director of Agriculture. Katie Kober could not be here today and sends her regards to this committee. I have a PowerPoint presentation, but in the interest of time, I will just give my remarks orally, if that's okay with the Chairman. And I have a copy here of it for you. The Oregon Department of Agriculture has an integrated program of services specifically targeted at Oregon agriculture, and I appreciate Representative Thatcher's question about Oregon agriculture, and thank you for remembering us. Our program includes services that include market development, product promotion, sector and rural development, market access, technical services, technology development, and transfer. In international market development, our primary focus is in the developed markets of Japan, Korea, and China. Strategies there that we employ on behalf of agriculture are trade shows, trade missions, as well as technical assistance. As an example, in Japan, in terms of market development, we had an Oregon pavilion at the Foodex show, the largest food show in Asia, had 12 Oregon companies there, including the famous Junki Yoshida, who is in Japan one of the most recognized faces in that marketplace, and he did very, very well. He also benefits the Port of Portland, I think, Bill, with his presence as well. We're also doing some real interesting work with the home shopping networks over there, where we can get small Oregon agricultural products in front of millions of people for virtually no cost. And the fulfillment of those products is through Northwest Airlines and other air cargo services out of Portland International. So, again, a nice tie-in there with the Port of Portland. One of the issues that we're following very closely is June 1st, the Japanese government imposed a new maximum residue level for pesticide residues, and we're working closely with the Northwest food processors to ensure that Oregon exporters are not locked out of the market, and we're using our Export Service Center laboratories, which are the only laboratories in the United States that are officially certified by the governments of Japan, Korea, Taiwan, Malaysia, Indonesia, Singapore, etc. And one of the things that makes our agency different, and I appreciate all these Representative Holby's question about what can the state do versus the federal government. Many times what we do is we can act on behalf of the federal government and provide this kind of official testing on a state level. And indeed, we've negotiated numerous export trade protocols that have benefited Oregon agricultural exporters on behalf of them that are unique and specific to just the state of Oregon. So we speak with a great deal of pride about the efficacy and importance of our export certification laboratories. In terms of Korea, our market development efforts, we've developed some very, very strong opportunities for ingredient products. Fresh potatoes, for instance, until we found a root nematode over in Idaho, we were shipping quite a few fresh potatoes to Korea for use in the potato chip industry over there. And we think that there's a superb opportunity for the export of live cattle to Korea once the mad cow BSE issues are resolved. In China, our program has built on some of the early successes, and these go back almost 25 years that our agency has been working in China to develop markets for grass seed. We own, as a result of that, almost 60% of the market share of grass seed sales in China, and that's up against some pretty significant competition such as New Zealand, Australia, Canada, and Denmark. We've leveraged that to include nursery stock now, and we have two demonstration gardens, one in Beijing and one in Shanghai. These are the official national demonstration gardens there, botanical gardens. And a result, to give you an idea of how big this is, we shipped 23 containers of nursery stock just for the samples or for the evaluation plants and so on for those markets. Another interesting thing that we've done is we've negotiated and signed
designed a unique strategic marketing protocol with the CCPIT, China Center for the International Promotion of Trade. This is a government equivalent of a chamber of commerce. They have 720 trade offices throughout China, and Oregon was selected because of Representative Mike Kopetsky, former Senator Representative Mike Kopetsky's affiliation with that. And so Oregon Department of Agriculture entered into this protocol where they will assist us in the marketing and promotion of agricultural products through their 720 offices. This gives us an incredible amount of reach as well as frequency, all at no cost to the state of Oregon. Department of Agriculture coordinates and conducts a number of targeted consumer promotion projects for agricultural products. We cooperate very closely with the Tourism Department as well as Brand Oregon, and along with the 28 Oregon Commodity Commissions, such as the Oregon Dairy Products, Oregon Dungeness Crab, etc. So we have a very strong connection there. Many of these product promotions offer retail opportunities for smaller producers. So not only the large companies such as Smartpack, but also the small startups and so on. Another thing that we're very actively involved is in what we characterize as sector and rural development. We work very closely with local and regional development officials. We identify constraints that are holding back our agricultural producers, things that are kind of getting in the way of their success. And one of the primary areas that we've seen in Oregon agriculture is this need to decommoditize the products. Senator Nelson, up in your part of the world where wheat is sold largely as a commodity, we have been working with wheat growers down in Gillam County to add value and to differentiate their product based on protein and baking characteristics to add value to an otherwise commodity product. Similar kind of project we're working on with 19 pea growers up there, where we've got them together and they're coming together to do some new product development work at the Food Innovation Center.
Could I ask a question?
Yes, of course.
Thank you. When you're speaking of this, it reminds me of Eastern Oregon beef, and you mentioned before mad cow disease. So does that become a prized commodity in Korea? Wasn't it in Korea, especially that you mentioned mad cow?
Yes.
Market, yeah. So does the Eastern Oregon beef, does that add value to beef exporting to Korea?
Mr. Chair, Representative Tomei, Oregon has a very good reputation in terms of having a healthy, natural, clean environment and so on. And one of the reasons that feedlot operators in Korea chose Oregon beef was because of that, because of the superior genetics and so on that we have here, as well as a well-developed transportation system that allowed us to bring a ship in and load the cattle literally on a cattle boat and send 800 live animals across the Pacific Ocean, not one of which died.
Wonderful. Thank you.
Yeah. So we're decommodifying things such as beef and wheat and processed vegetables, and certainly down in Representative Senator Johnson's area, seafood is another area where we're looking at. Market access and certification services. One of the unique things about the Oregon Department of Agriculture is that we've got a very large back room. We have entire divisions within our agency that are responsible for plant health and safety, inspection, etc. And so what we have done is we've utilized that expertise and that specific knowledge and skill to develop a range of certification services such as export certification that I mentioned earlier, but also things such as certifying agricultural products for good agricultural practices or good handling practices systems. These kinds of certifications, particularly for the fresh produce industry, have meant amazing real bottom line benefit. Packers of potatoes down in Klamath Falls, for instance, get well over $1.50 more per hundredweight for the potatoes if they participate in these good agricultural practices, good handling practices programs that we provide. They make $1.50 more per hundredweight. We charge them about 32 cents to do that. So these are cost recovery programs that are very, very effective. Another interesting thing is
our relationship and partnership with Oregon State University at the Food Innovation Center, and I would invite any of you who have not had a chance to go there to come visit us. This is a purpose-built facility that is a partnership between the Oregon Department of Agriculture and Oregon State School of Ag Sciences, where we have professional staff and really invested in a great deal of technology as well as infrastructure to assist Oregon food producers add value to the products. One of the things that we're very excited about working on, and I wish we could show you on the screen a little bigger picture, is we're working with the Department of Electrical Engineering at Oregon State University to develop some systems for RFID, radio frequency ID programs, to identify food products within the streams of commerce. What's interesting about these technologies are that they can confer upon a product not only where it's been, but under what conditions it's been handled. And in the marketplace, this is a way to add value to the products. Finally, just to take home, I'd like to say that agricultural business marketing development is one of the three core policy areas of the Oregon Department of Agriculture, the other being food safety and natural resources. We take our job very seriously and those responsibilities seriously. I think we've built a unique program with both technical competence as well as market savvy. We are recognized worldwide as well as nationally for our innovation and success, and I like to think that we deliver meaningful developmental services for Oregon's agricultural and fisheries sectors on a daily basis. Thank you very much.
Any questions? Okay, a few questions. Do we have any plan in case there are birds, aviation flu, birds flu, and what kind of a backup plan we have?
Mr. Chair, the Oregon Department of Agriculture works very closely with the U.S. Department of Agriculture in this manner, and there is a very active emergency plan that has been put in place, particularly for the poultry production area here within the state. We also cooperate very closely with the Department of Human Services on the human aspect of this, but the Oregon State veterinarian has put in place, I think, a very comprehensive plan to ensure that we minimize the effect if it does appear here in Oregon.
Okay, and another question. When was the last time we shipped the live cattle to Korea or Japan? When was the last time?
Mr. Chair, the last shipment was 2 months before the mad cow was found in Washington State. That would have been 2004, I believe. Christmas of 2003, that was the the cow that stole Christmas that year. It was discovered on Christmas Eve.
And it turns out that Dallin and myself, we were talking about some cattle holding yard in the Dallas area. Mm-hmm. And what happened since then? Any thought on that?
Representative Lim, because we've been unable to ship live animals from the United States to any of the principal markets, primarily Taiwan, China, Korea, or Japan, interest in the private sector has really cooled. However, when this situation gets sorted out at a national level, I think that interest will be reinvigorated.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Welcome.
If there's no other questions, then Mr. Bill Wyatt, welcome.
Thank you for coming again.
Thank you, Chairman, and members of the committee. I'm Bill Wyatt. I'm Executive Director of the Port of Portland, and I believe that we have submitted testimony, and I'm just going to kind of go off the written record here a little and give you a little, I think, perspective about the port. I think it would be useful to have. The port is a kind of an interesting organization. We're technically a municipal subdivision of the state of Oregon, like TriMet in that respect. We have a three-county jurisdiction, although I would say that our influence extends well beyond the three counties of Clackamas, Washington, and Multnomah. We have a nine-member commission whose members are appointed by the governor, confirmed by the Senate. We were created back in 1890. 1991 for the express purpose of constructing a navigation channel from Portland to the mouth of the Columbia River. In those days, almost entirely driven by the strong desire to export wheat to the various parts of the world, and things have grown since then. In those days, the port itself actually did not own marine terminals. We simply constructed the navigation channel. In later years, developed the airport at Swan Island and then moved it to its current location. And then in 1971, the Oregon Legislature, the City of Portland, and the Port of Portland all got together and merged the current and the modern port, because the City of Portland owned and operated all of the marine terminals. The Commission on Public Docks was a city agency, and these things were then merged. So we are unique in that respect, but also because we are a consolidated port. We operate, own and operate airports. We own and operate a seaport. There are only five like us in the country: Seattle, Portland, Oakland, Massport, Massachusetts Port Authority, and New York, New Jersey, which itself is unique because it's a bi-state port. We have four marine terminals. We export potash and soda ash, both of which are basic industrial building blocks. The potash comes out of Saskatoon in 120-car unit trains. It is primarily a fertilizing agent. And this is just a little story about what's happening in the global economy these days. This potash is going primarily to places in Asia, being used to fertilize crops, to grow food, to sell to China, who's growing middle class, also has a growing appetite. And that's a story that we see reflected in Oregon export statistics generally. The market in China is growing as a result of this large, increasingly wealthy middle class, which is growing in their expectations as well. We export soda ash, which comes from Wyoming, and again, large quantities, probably 4 million tons of soda ash. It goes to points around the world, but again, primarily to Asia. It's used as a stabilizing agent in glass. If you live in an old house that has old glass, and when you move back and forth and you see it wobble, that's pre-stabilizing agent. Now modern glass doesn't have that changing quality or characteristic, and that's because we use soda ash to actually stabilize the glass. It is used primarily in the manufacture of automobile glass. We export wheat at the Port of Portland. There are several terminals on the Columbia River that export wheat. Ours is leased to the Columbia Grain Company, which is a subsidiary of Marubeni, one of the largest of the Japanese trading companies. They'll do probably 3 million tons of wheat this year, about a quarter of which actually comes from Oregon, the rest of it from Washington, some from Idaho, and then from points as far away as Kansas, Nebraska, and the Dakotas, which arrives here by train. We import a lot of steel, which comes from all parts of the world. Much of it goes to Oregon Steel Mills, which is located very close to our facilities. And interestingly, it gets rolled into steel pipe that's being used today in the natural gas industry. Oregon has a very strong market in the production of energy-related products for that industry. We import automobiles more than any other port on the West Coast. Our accounts are Toyota, Hyundai, which of course is a Korean company, and Honda, Japanese company. We'll do about 400,000 units of automobiles this year, and if you want to just get a little perspective, every time one of those autos rolls off onto one of our terminals, it generates about $350 of local labor in value before it heads off to its final point of destination. So so it's a very successful product for us. And, of course, we have a container facility at our Terminal 6 on the Columbia River. It was created years ago primarily to facilitate trade in exported products, agricultural products, things like frozen french fries, which go to Japan, compressed hay, which is used primarily but not exclusively in Japan, increasingly paper products, which are going to China, and then after that, everything you can imagine, peas, lentils, beans, hides, waste paper, steel from shredded auto bodies, which goes to China, some to Korea, and our import volumes are growing significantly, which is also a strong indication about what's happening in this country. Our imports from Asia and elsewhere are growing. We've had some recent success in the container business. It's always a struggle in Portland. We have a small market on a global scale, that is, and the container companies don't particularly enjoy having to bring their large vessels up 106 miles of the Columbia River with two pilots, a bar pilot and a river pilot, but frankly, the congestion in the container business on the West Coast is beginning to change the economics in a way that supports this business in the Columbia River. It's very important for us because our agricultural exporters, in many cases, without a container service on the Columbia River, would really be out of luck. It's just too expensive to put on trucks or trains to send up and down the West Coast to other facilities. So this is a very important business for us. In the airport, we own and operate PDX. We also own Hillsborough Airport, Molino, which is a very small general aviation airport in Clackamas County, and the Troutdale Airport, which is really right at the beginning of the Columbia River Gorge next to Interstate 84. PDX is a remarkable facility. We've worked very hard the last few years to establish non-stop international service to continental Europe and to Asia and now also to Mexico. The good news is that we've been able to do all that in working closely with the business community in particular. But I think the sobering news is that we are the smallest market in the United States that has non-stop service to these various destinations. And as was explained to me in no uncertain terms by a senior vice president of one of the major carriers, you know, if Portland were obvious, we'd already be there. And the point of all that is we have a very small market. We think of Portland as, you know, as Oregon's largest city, an international city in so many respects, but the truth is, on a global scale, we're a small market, and so competing for these international services is particularly difficult and challenging and requires us to work very closely and very aggressively with our partners in the private sector, frankly, the Nikes, the Intels, and companies of that sort who supply such an enormous volume of the business class travelers. That's what attracts these carriers. Why is it valuable? You know, just I was at the airport this afternoon before I came down here at a meeting and saw the Lufthansa plane pulling up. Plane is, you know, valued at $150, $160 million. It lands every day. It generates every year about $100 million worth of activity directly associated with the landing and takeoff of that plane alone. It means for frequent business travelers hours and hours and hours and hours a year of free time that they would otherwise be devoted to flying to San Francisco and then flying to Europe, flying to Los Angeles and then flying to Europe, or to Asia as well. So these are enormously important. They also provide air cargo access to these key and very, very important markets. Just a couple of statistics about PDX. Every day, about 9,500 people get up and go to work at the airport. It's a small city. I was born and raised in Astoria, and the airport employs more people than live in my old hometown of Astoria. It takes a tremendous number of people to get up every day and make the place function. This year, we'll accommodate somewhere between 14.2 and 14.5 million passengers, people who come and go. The airport occupies about 3,000 acres, and as I said, is a has a remarkable economic impact on the region. The smaller airports are important for a couple of reasons. They help relieve some of the general aviation pressure that PDX experiences. And Hillsborough plays a very important role in Washington County. Intel flies its own shuttle service in and out of Hillsborough to their various locations up and down the West Coast. So four or five times a day, a small commercial jet lands at Hillsborough and takes off to Chandler, Arizona, or up to Washington, or down to San Jose, California, to their various facilities. It is Oregon's second busiest airport in terms of passenger volume, even though there are no actual commercial flights. We met this morning with Hillsborough Aviation, which is one of the world's largest helicopter training companies. They're located at Hillsborough, and they're beginning now to train pilots for airlines all over the world, particularly in Asia, where this business is growing. So that's just a little background, and I would leave you with this. We're largely enterprise-funded. This year, our revenues will be around $230 to $240 million. And of that, all but 3% are generated as a result of business transactions. So somebody who we're working with has got to figure out how to make a buck in order to do business with us so that we can continue to operate successfully. It makes for an entrepreneurial organization, which I appreciate. I think that's important. We have a little tiny property tax that is levied in the metropolitan area, $7 million a year. But everything else comes to us as a result of a business transaction, from dockage, from passenger fees, from airline landing fees, and so on and so forth, terminal rents, and that kind of thing. And I think while our competitors in Seattle and Tacoma and in California, right across the river in Vancouver, all have a larger portion of public support, I'll be honest with you, I think in our case, it's helped make us more sharply focused. We know where the bottom line is and how to get there quickly because we have to. And so we operate very much like a public business. We couldn't succeed without our private partners, and so we work very, very closely with them. I'd be happy, I would say we will, of course, take part in the governor's trade mission. We travel a lot because most of our customers, frankly, are not here. They're overseas, the carriers and others. This is a very aggressive agenda that has been put forward for the governor. I hope you've seen the itinerary. It's very hard to travel to these foreign countries and start at 6:30 in the morning and end at 10 at night and come back with your sanity intact. And so I'm assuming he's seen it and has approved. But I'm very impressed by the quality of the agenda. It's a large group to travel with, which is always complex, but I'm very pleased. We'll be seeing our customers, Hanjin Shipping in Korea, Hyundai Automobiles, Hyundai Merchant Marine, and others in Korea, and then be going on to Japan with the governor as well. Be happy to answer any questions.
Any questions?
Okay. Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Bill. I appreciate all the work you're doing at the port because it helps me out in Eastern Oregon, and I appreciate that. Somebody asked a question about India and why we aren't doing more business. Do you have any insights
in where?
In India?
India? Well, there is actually a lot of business going on in India, and I can just tell you this little story. We work, in the case of Lufthansa, we work very closely with them to be certain that they are making contact with all of the potential customers, passengers, companies who need passenger access, because this plane lands every day. It's got 240 seats, and, you know, if it's not reasonably full, they're not going to want to stick around. So we have to really be on our toes. That's a large capacity for a small market like ours, so we're always working closely with them. And as we began to examine this flight, and it's a very sophisticated business, it requires a tremendous amount of data crunching and so forth, it became clear to us that there were a fair number of people flying from the Portland area to India, and we're not using Lufthansa, and the reason was the connect in Frankfurt, which is where our flight goes to. It's one of the largest hubs in the world, 70 million passengers a year, and they have flights to 190 different locations from Frankfurt. So people were going to India, but they were getting there elsewhere, over Newark or maybe Los Angeles. So we sat down with Lufthansa and looked at retiming the departure of our flight to connect with their flights to the Middle East, to Tel Aviv, which is a big market for us because of Intel, to Hyderabad, to Bangalore, and to other of the high-tech centers in India. And they've done so, and that's not easy because these big hub airports are constrained. You buy landing spots, and so when you move them around, it's a very expensive proposition. It affects the profitability of the flight, so it was a big risk. We worked with them. They retimed the flight. Now it's about an hour and a half, I think, connect, which is cutting it close because it's about a 9 to 10 hour flight from here to there in the first place, and it's had a stunning impact. Intel, the last time I was there, I took this flight about a month ago, and on the way back I was standing in line behind three folks from Microsoft who'd actually flown down from Seattle to take this flight to Tel Aviv, which is where I actually had was headed, and so there is a lot of business between Oregon and India, and I would say I want to keep mentioning actually Haifa, Israel, which is a major high-tech center. Intel does a lot of their wireless work there, and India is obviously growing, particularly in the research and service sectors. We don't see it on the ocean side, to be honest with you, and that has a lot to do with geography, frankly. Most of our connections are in Asia, in India. In fact, Bangalore, I think, is almost precisely halfway around the world, so you can get there going either direction. But I think you will find that companies like Nike or the other companies in the footwear, athletic design business are doing a significant increase in activity in India. They're doing a lot of design work, a lot of manufacturing, and Intel and the other high-tech companies here are increasingly doing a lot of work in India. And I think it's a story like this. There's still, even though there's a lot of excitement about India, they're still very small in scale, but it's growing dramatically. And so I think you will see more activity of that sort developing over time.
We were talking about the green transportation now, the big push now is ethanol and corn. We're going to bring most of that in probably from the Midwest. Do you see that's going to cause any huge problem for the port? I mean, the railroads, from what I hear, say they're stretched at capacity now. How are they going to add another 12 or 15 or 20 or 30 million bushels of grain and still?
That is a really good question. And I think, to be candid, I think it's going to limit our ability in this region to produce ethanol, because it's often a two-way trip. The corn comes out, it is processed in a variety of ways, but then there's a tremendous amount of material left over that has to go somewhere. And I think that's the part that people forget about the ethanol business. You know, the corn is still there at the end. It's lost about a quarter of its volume, but you still have an enormous volume of material. The plant that is in Senator Johnson's district, or the one that's anticipated at the Port of St. Helens, will actually ship the product out afterwards. There is a market, a feed market, and a fertilizing market, I believe, for this product, but it's limited. My guess, if I were guessing, I think a lot of the ethanol production will probably occur, frankly, where the product is grown in the Midwest. I know that the railroads are anticipating that. We do not have, in this region, much rail capacity remaining. We have limited slots, and I think all of us are going to want to think long and hard about using it for something like ethanol production if it constrains or limits the ability of our own producers to have access to the transcontinental rail network. And I think that's kind of what we're facing. So rail economics will really drive the location, I think, of the ethanol plants.
One last question. Multimodal thing that was going on, and you were trying to do something about aggression.
Yes.
And at one point you were talking about going even as far as Arlington or someplace like that. Where is that at? Or when do you see that
place? Well, as a result of action taken in the last session, it's nowhere for I think another 7 years, or I can't remember exactly what it was. But just a brief comment. We purchased, or are in the process of purchasing, a large piece of property in East Multnomah County. It was an aluminum plant. They closed the aluminum plant. Alcoa did. They wanted to sell it. It's a very complex piece of property. It's a Superfund site, so they're cleaning it up. Not many private takers for that. Secondly, it is crisscrossed by large power lines as a result of the location of the aluminum plant there. But it's prime industrial property, and so one of the aspects of the port that I did not dwell on is that we're the largest owner, seller, developer of industrial land in the metropolitan area, owing largely to history. Using the port's dredge, the one that helped, you know, create and maintain the navigation channel over time, to create industrial land. So we have a fair inventory of industrial land. This was a great opportunity to add to that. So we are, sometime in the next 6 months or so, we'll take possession of that. The property in question has several unique features. It's on Interstate 84. It is very long and narrow, so you could bring in a full intermodal train, 8,000 foot train, without having to break it into pieces. That's very important because in the logistics and in the freight business, every time you touch it, it costs money. So being able to bring it in full is extremely important. But most important, I think, is this. The state of Oregon is very constrained in rail capacity. Lots of reasons for that, and we're not alone, happening all over the West. The primary reason for that isn't the tracks between, say, here and Chicago. It's what happens at each end. It's the congestion in the hub areas. And Portland is a huge rail hub. This is the northwestern terminus of the Union Pacific Railroad, and they make something like 10% of their corporate income in Oregon, 5% on our property around. So just a huge volume of activity. The intermodal facility that you talked of is simply to be certain that we have the capacity going forward to handle the huge volumes of freight that have been thus far accurately forecast to materialize. It is, I think I can safely say, a very controversial topic. The visual that typically conjures up in someone's head is not terribly appealing, and the port, by luck of the draw, happens to operate a lot of facilities that no one would particularly want to live next to. Airports, seaports, intermodal facilities, and I would say at the end of the day, increasing and expanding the capacity of the railroads to handle intermodal freight in Oregon is a very important issue. In our case, we couldn't do this without a customer, and there is only one in this case, and that's the Union Pacific, because that's their main line. My read on their interest, frankly, is that they're probably probably not interested at that facility. And I think that comes as great news to the people who live in the immediate vicinity. I think it's a bit more troubling, frankly, for the region and for folks at your end of the pipeline, because that congestion serves to really make the price of rail transportation more expensive, slower, and less serviceable for large-scale producers. But my take is that they are not interested in making the kind of commitment that would be required. For us, okay, it's great industrial property. We'll have no trouble finding large industrial customers because land, industrial land in metropolitan areas is in short supply, and there are lots of people who would be very attracted to that. It'll be a great service. We'll come out of it fine financially. We knew that going in. So it's a lost opportunity in a sense, but certainly not the final word. We'll have to look around and see what else can be done. But I think that's part of our role, is to help the railroads and help the community and others figure out how to solve these big challenging problems, but this one will be a challenge for all of us.
Okay, I have a couple of questions, if I may. Do you have any questions? No? Okay. All right, let me see. One question I have, my district area, Troutdale area, you were considering some transitional the rail yard in that area. Still working on it, or it's out of
it? Well, I guess the best way to put that, I tried to address this with Senator Nelson, is we are still acquiring the property, and I would say we're another 6 months away or so, because Alcoa is in the midst of a cleanup of the property, and we need to be satisfied that that's been accomplished before we take title. Any consideration of a rail facility is well off into the future, and as I just indicated to Senator Nelson, I think it's less likely now than I might have a couple of years ago, because it requires a customer. The Union Pacific is the only customer for such a facility because they own the main line that is adjacent, and if they're not interested, it's just not going to happen. In my sense, Representative Lynn, is that they're probably not interested. It's okay, as I said, because it's a great industrial parcel, and we'll have no problem finding customers looking for 50 or 100 acre parcels in the metropolitan area. There just aren't any. We own the only ones there are, and I can tell you they're in hot demand.
Okay, another question. Still a lot of people complaining about the noise in the area. And do you have any plan for noise abatement issue, and how do you address those? This is a big issue in that area.
Yeah. We deal with it every day. Airports, large commercial airports, do generate noise. And we have just completed what the FAA calls a Part 150 noise abatement process. Very expensive. Took 2 years. We have adjusted the flight tracks a bit to avoid as much of the residential area as possible. One of the reasons, interestingly, that the airport was moved years and years and years ago from Swan Island to its current location is the availability of the Columbia River as a noise abatement corridor, and that still is the primary strategy around airport noise. The largest, of course, airport noise producers, plane noise producers, are the F-15s, so they're stationed at the airport, and by a very large order of magnitude. Planes in flight are the exclusive jurisdiction of the FAA, so we have to work very closely with them and with the airlines, frankly, in responding to noise complaints. We do have a policy of insulating homes if they fall within a certain noise envelope. That was a part of the study to find out if the noise envelope had changed at all, but it's a constant process. We probably have a staff of 8 people at the airport who do nothing but respond to noise complaints, and part of our job is someone calls and says, you know, last night at 11:30 there was a plane over my house and it was really loud. We can actually go back and look at the flight tracks and see, was the pilot where he was supposed to be? Was he too low? Was he too high? Was he off course? You know what? Every once in a while, it happens. You call the airline. I write them personally a letter because I've sent many of these. You send them a letter and say, hey, flight, you know, Alaska Flight 403 at 11:54 last night was off track, and we would appreciate it if you would. They will often respond and say, well, there were extenuating circumstances. There was another flight over here. There was another plane. There was a this or was that. But it's really important because these are not one-time only events. If you live there, this is a persistent activity. And so you end up communicating with the same people time after time after time. And I think it is worth the energy that we put into responding. But just know that airports create noise. And there is a limit to what you can do to really influence that. But
we appreciate your effort. But when they are flying low in the Columbia River, salmons and all the fish might complain.
We haven't had too many of those complaints yet, but I'm sure they're right around the corner.
Okay, and this is my personal note. Since you are collecting about $7 million a year, right, from the property taxes, why are you continually increasing the parking ticket in the airport area? This seems to be too high.
First of all, the airport is entirely enterprise funded. The $7 million that we collect goes into the general fund, which is marine and properties. So we have to build parking facilities, the roadways. Everything you see at the airport is paid for either by parking, landing fees, you name it, any of those resources. So we're about to build another parking garage because we're virtually out of short-term parking. I think, though, and if you're interested in this, I'd be happy to show you a chart. There's not another international airport in the country where you will find parking as inexpensively as you will find it at Portland, but it's very expensive to build anything at the Portland Airport, and part of it has to do with the fact that it's actually below the level of the Columbia River. So the water table is about an inch. As a result, pilings, and this is the most challenging part to building these parking garages, is driving the pilings, which are very deep and very expensive. So the construction cost for an airport parking space is about double what it would be in downtown Portland, largely because of the foundation related issues, and I might add now because of the blast characteristics required by the FAA. So these, they're going up, but they're never coming down. They're very expensive to build and therefore expensive to operate.
Okay. I have a couple more questions, but I would reserve it for the next time. But thank you very much for the fine job you are doing.
Thank you.
And I appreciate it. And God bless.
Thank you.
Okay. Before we go, we have just one agenda among our legislators. And concerning, I'm sure you have the copy of the letter that to the speaker, Karen Minnis, do you have the copy of it? Yes. And I'd like to, this letter should be under the House, under the joint committee letter. And everyone, our members, need to be signed if you wish to, and then we are sending to the speaker and also the president. So this is a joint letter asking the leadership to allow us to have a joint committee in this coming session. So I'd like to open up a discussion if you have any questions on this matter. Last time we discussed it, and some of them need more time, so we give you the time 2 months now. So, okay. Representative Thatcher.
Were we to each sign our own individual letter, or do you
have one, just one letter
for us to sign?
Okay. Yes. Okay, so that might happen. It's up to the leadership to make a final decision. So I'm doing it, and Senator Johnson and myself, and we are doing it because it's a statutory first, and this will save the time, and this will show to the people that we are working together. This is a good perception to the public. Instead of a divided house, we are going to be unified, hopefully. Okay, so we are going to, if you agree to it, we will let the draft in a new letter and in the committee form letter, and the next meeting we will all let the sign it, hopefully, then we will send it to the respective leaders, to our the two chambers. Okay? Is any other business you'd like to discuss at this time?
If I could just remind the committee members, our next meeting will be August 17th in Astoria.
Okay. Astoria. Okay. What time is it? Do you know?
I don't have that much information yet.
Okay. We will let you know after that. And with that, meeting is adjourned.